your favorite cartoon characters will help you understand how drugs and alcohol can ruin your life. So watch the program. Talk about it with your family.
Make the right
to one of the specialist special presentations with Mike and Ethan, and once again, Lindsay, one of our all-time favorite guest stars.
Oh, thank you. That's remarkably gratifying to know.
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, we always look forward to doing these things with you, and, you know, it's kind of to our discredit that it's been so long since last time, but it was great to have you back last Halloween, at least. But
oh, yeah.
This is something that we've had in the works for a while, and I guess we kind of wanted to lead up to it because it was such an event. So, Lindsay is with us to celebrate what is probably the biggest comic strip event of the last 30 years. The Dick Tracy movie!
I mean, it's the biggest comic strip event of the past 30 years until, say, they release the Chris Pratt Garfield movie.
Yeah, yeah, then pretty much.
It's going to blow it out of the water.
Wait, is Chris... is that real?
Yeah.
That is a real thing, and Chris Pratt is playing Garfield.
Oh. Okay, I have nothing else to say about that.
I know that sounded like a joke, like, he's voicing everything. He really is voicing everything.
What a terrible choice.
I'm wow. sorry to break this live on air.
He was wow.
I mean, he was better than I expected as Mario, but still Garfield?
Yeah. They have been just flailing ever since we lost Lorenzo Music. I mean,
yeah.
Sorry. It's, yeah.
I don't know if that's better or worse than Garfield just being silent.
They should just retire Garfield like, you know, Lionel Hutz.
Lyman Hutz.
Yeah.
What if it was like a thing of everyone else talks in the movie and Garfield just goes through a series of comic misadventures, not unlike Jacques Tati? You know, like it's just like entirely in mime. He's sort of a Candide like fool character thrust upon the world.
So Garfield in Mon Oncle?
Exactly.
This is a wild new interpretation of the character, but
yeah,
can you imagine how funny it would be to watch like a fat orange cat struggle with a lawn chair?
And the best part is he doesn't even have to be animated. You can use a guy in a suit.
So basically we're just gonna do Lasagna Cat.
Yeah, pretty much.
Alright, yeah, I'm down with that.
Or better yet, instead of a suit, he could have a series of very elaborately placed facial prosthetics that make him look exactly like the character, and yet nothing at all like the character.
Wait, I got a better idea. Okay, check this out.
Would that require, like, an air conditioning unit inside the suit, like Mike Myers?
It would, yeah. So wait, I've got an idea that won't require an air conditioning unit at all. Okay, check this. It's the exact same idea, but instead of a Garfield in, like, a fursuit... It's a guy, like a normal guy, and he's wearing like a 3-piece suit that's orange. It's basically Nathan Masry's Garfield suit. Anyway,
yes, but I've seen Nathan. He's a slim little fella. How are we going to bulk him up for the role?
We have our ways. We have our little ways.
Well, I see. This is a new DeviantArt story taking form as we speak. Anyway, but we were...
It's like Sean Young showing up in the Catwoman costume she made herself. It's just like Nathan Masry showing up and he's 350 pounds.
Well, you know what? We should pitch this to him. I bet Nathan would be down. He'd be like, look, Nathan, all you have to do is just go to your own restaurant and eat everything on the menu. Eat a million Garfuccinos. Not eat them. Drink them. You drink a Garfuccino. Yeah. Oh my god, I forgot whether you eat or drink a liquid.
put that piece that kind of Carpaccino. Kind of looks like Garfield's head in a blender and drink that.
Man, I don't think we even need to talk about Dick Tracy.
Yeah. But yeah, okay, Dick Tracy. This was a big deal in 1990, or at least it was something that they had. Disney put about $100 million worth of advertisement behind this, or maybe that was the total cost of the movie plus the advertising, and it made about $50 million. So,
you know,
it was technically a thing, whereas like I think they made it. It says like they made back $162 million worldwide. So it wasn't like a total bomb, but I think it was.
It was not the hit that they wanted. No,
it was like one of those, the first instances of modern blockbusters where it becomes a disappointment for like only barely making back 4 times its budget.
Mm. Huh. Yeah, I was.
And also, like a sign of the movie industry getting too big to fail.
Hmm. I was actually under the impression this was a huge hit because, only because, like Annie, the marketing blitz was so huge that as a child, I just assumed, oh, yeah, that was a big deal. And it wasn't until I was an adult I was like, oh, no, this was not.
No. Sort of like, you know, if you were that age when it came out, you would be forgiven for thinking that The Rocketeer had been a big deal. But
oh, I thought it was. You mean The Rocketeer?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, wow. Well,
America did not get Rocketeer fever.
Yes.
Well, I wish they had.
See, what happened was, after the success of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, Disney tried to bring out a sort of diesel punk movie every year for a while there. There was Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and then there was Dick Tracy, and then there was The Rocketeer. And did they do The Shadow, or was that someone else?
I believe that may have been someone else.
Oh, okay.
Well, there was kind of a craze for, like, classic kind of detective comic type movies. I feel like this was very shortly after Tim Burton's Batman, so.
Oh, yeah, they were absolutely trying to make their own Batman, but they were like, let's do Batman by way of Roger Rabbit. This feels like they really wanted to do Roger Rabbit 2.
I put it more in the vein of two-fisted pulp quote-unquote actioneers that they were making around that time, where it's like, hey, let's bring back the spirit of the 30s because you know, it's fun and daring, and more importantly, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade made a shit ton of money. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a proven formula. But then you get stuff like The Rocketeer, which does it's a disappointment. Mm-hmm. And The Shadow fails, and The Phantom fails, and by the time we get to Sky Captain and The World of Tomorrow, they're just like, alright, that's it. Pack it up. We're not... Fuck this.
Yeah. Nobody remembers the 30s anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
The last dying gasp of that, I would say, is probably that third Mummy movie where they go to China that has been mostly forgotten by time.
Hmm. Yeah, I guess the 30s just didn't have the allure that people thought they would.
Mm-mm.
But, yeah. I mean, that makes sense, because the 30s, they were a sucky decade. They were a sucky decade. Everyone knows that decades go in, like, it's every other decade is good. Like, the 20s was cool, you know, and then, yeah, the 40s is cool. The 30s is just, like, that's Depression era. So, you know, I don't know why
and
I thought
the 60s was almost not cool, but then it made a big swing into cool at the last minute.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
the 60s was catching up for lost time.
Yeah. But so Dick Tracy, it's it's, you know, I'll give him credit. They really went for the gusto with this one. It looks amazing. There's so much cool stuff in this movie. I wish it was good.
Yeah. You know, this movie, I believe, suffers from the Mike Wazowski syndrome. As in, you know, as Mike put it in the second Monsters, Inc. movie, is that he thought that if he wanted it the most, he could get it.
Yeah. It is, so this is like...
I thought it was the Mike Wazowski problem because every single character seems out of focus compared to everyone else.
Yeah, everyone else is blocked out by the UPC symbol or something.
this was really impressive because this is probably the last of these movies that was done all practical effects because... Oh, yeah. Sky Captain, which is in a similar vibe and came out, a few years later. That was all
04.
Oh, that was in 04. Okay. So
I remember very distinctly being like a 12-year-old kid, like reading a magazine, and I came across like an ad for Sky Captain starring Jude Law, and I was like, okay, I would love to see this guy fight these big robots, but I have a feeling that America won't. Like, even as a child, I understood this has a limited appeal.
Yeah.
Yeah. I remember seeing it on a plane and just being like, because they were like, hey, it's all computer generated. This is the future. And I remember watching it and being like, oh, yeah. Yeah, it is. It's made in a computer. Oh, that's, yeah, well. That's
it's
a thing.
It's
in the computer. Which, you know, I remember being like, oh, this is gonna be cool. And it's like, oh, I guess it's not. I guess it's okay. Which is kind of how Dick Tracy is. I watched it and I was like, oh, this is gonna be cool. And then I watched it and it was like, I guess not. It's okay.
Yeah.
I think the practical effects approach to making everything a limited color palette, which is an interesting idea, but I feel it gets one of those stylistic choices that works best for, like, a 30-second toy commercial.
Mm.
Because after a point, like, the lighting in this movie is either... It can be very harsh at times, which is a shame, because there's some truly beautiful prosthetic appliances in this film that you can't really see properly because everything is either chiaroscuro to create like the perfect silhouettes or like part of it has to be an artsy shadow and part of it has to be like very well lit and part of it has to be completely in darkness. Yeah. And you have to do the lighting thing anyway to relegate the color temperature. So after a while, not to mention that the suits and the costumes do definitely have like a Disney stunt show feel to it.
That is a good way to put it. There's
a lot of really nice... In the very first scene, you have a lot of really nice prosthetics and outfits and everything, but it's in such dim light, and also you can tell that they didn't trust themselves because one of the most spectacular ones is only shown in extreme close-up when he was clearly designed to be seen as if, you know, around the table with the others.
Yeah, I think that was the thing that's like... we don't want to build too big a set for Littleface Finny, but also we don't want to do, like, comp work on backdrops or matte paintings or, like, chroma key or anything like that. So let's just... it doesn't look like he's got a little face in extreme close-up so much as it looks like he's got a gigantic head.
Which he did.
And it moves around like a guy clearly underneath a much larger costume. I the effect is admirable for what they tried to do, but I don't think quite comes together in execution, yeah. Which you could say about a lot of this.
Yeah. I don't think he could talk in that head because... Yeah, when they show Littleface, it's just extreme close-ups on his face, and he's just looking at the camera. He's not doing anything. He's always just looking at you.
He sort of grumbles, and he's like, well, Littleface? Ugh.
Yeah, because I don't think the actor could say anything. And that is... that. Well, but yeah, this is a movie that has, you know, some... A lot of fidelity to detail and trying to get the look of Dick Tracy characters, whom we've spoken about before, are all hideous freaks. And
The look, not so much the personalities, though.
No, that is the big problem in this movie. They were. It's like, what are the personalities of Dick Tracy's rogues gallery? Eh.
Yeah.
Guys, you know.
This movie. See, let's compare it again to Batman. With the Batman movies, you generally had two villains, maybe three in the case of Batman and Robin. But, you know, that was enough to have them play off of each other. And, you know, this is like if you had a Batman movie and the first Batman movie had the Joker and the Riddler and Two-Face and Catwoman and Clayface and Hugo Strange and Dr. Death and, you know, fucking onomatopoeia, and then you just sort of had them all sort of piled together in an elevator and not say anything.
The Eraser and Zebra Man and King Tut and Egghead are all commuting here. Let's wait a few minutes.
Yeah.
I kind of admire, because this isn't really a film that sets this up for a sequel. I have no idea whether or not they had, like, franchise plans, but while I do appreciate, like, the go-for-broke nature of that, like, it's not like modern comics adaptations where it's like, oh, we're going to tease future villains. It's just like they got them in a big bag and they essentially dumped them all out on screen, and because it's like, we're never going to have another chance to do this. But at the same time, what it results in is a lot of characters and very little personality between them.
Yeah. It's basically the Dick Tracy is fighting his entire rogues gallery. You know, we see them all, and it's like, you see them and it's like, oh yeah, there's Flat Top. I know him because he's got a flat top. And there's Mumbles. I know him because he mumbles. But none of them have much to do in this.
No.
There's one main villain. It's Big Boy Caprice. And he's played by Al Pacino, playing Al Pacino, you know.
Doing an impression of Robert De Niro.
Oh, is that what he's trying to do?
Yes.
Because
I described when I was talking to a friend who saw Dick Tracy for the first time a while ago, I described Big Boy Caprice as like Danny DeVito's Penguin if it sucked.
Yeah.
Because he's just, like, fucking waddling around in this brick-shaped fat suit that looks a little bit ridiculous. It's just, like, he says a bunch of stuff, and very little of it is of consequence.
Well, the thing with Big Boy Caprice is that's a good description. He's like the Penguin. I was trying to figure out his theme throughout the movie. It's like, because his name is Big Boy, so I would expect he's, like, a big guy. And he's not really. They basically gave him, like, a padded ass. And, you know, otherwise, it's just Al Pacino yelling and doing his usual, I'm Al Pacino thing. Which, I think this was probably the last movie. No, this is the first movie where he just stopped acting. Because I think it was after this that every time you see him, he's just doing that thing, you know? He's the Al Pacino. He's the guy you call if you want to see Al Pacino play Al Pacino, you know?
Yeah.
I would say that he's not a big man, but I think the thing is, like, he's a big boy because he carries himself like a big boy. Like, he thinks big. Like,
well, he is significantly shorter, like, than everyone else, I noticed. You know, I thought it was supposed to be
ironic. One Napoleon, one Washington, one me! And, like, he's always, like, quoting famous people and misdescribing them.
Like,
he's got a lot of delusions of grandeur and eloquence.
Okay. I mean,
it's a character of sorts.
When you wish upon a star, your dreams come true. That's Jim Henson.
I get it. I mean, they did some of that in the movie. I feel like it didn't come across as much as they wanted, just because. I mean, this is my thing. This might be just me, though, because I could not watch this movie and not see Al Pacino, you know? Like, every scene he's in, I'm like, hey, it's Al Pacino.
It's kind of just called him Big Boy Pacino.
Well, it's like, you know, like some actors really disappear into a role. It's the opposite with Al Pacino. Roles disappear into him. So, you know, so I'm just like, eh.
You're right, because if you look at the actual history of Dick Tracy, Big Boy Caprice is basically an original character for this movie. There was a Big Boy, but it's Big Boy Famoni.
Oh, okay. I guess they were like, look, we need someone who's, like you said, who can hold all these villains together. So we're going to create someone new for that role.
And I have read the the first few collected years of Dick Tracy, and Big Boy is like significant as the villain whose machinations kill Tessa's father and inspire Dick Tracy to join the police force in the first place. So I would describe him as like, he's a decent starter villain for what this is, but at the same time, this movie is very much not an origin story.
No.
So he doesn't become like it is for other characters, but Dick Tracy shows up like fully formed as if he sprang out of the head of Zeus. And as a result, Big Boy is not a rallying figure for Dick to take up the badge so much as he is like a rallying figure for criminals to gather together and pool their forces.
Would you say that it's Big Boy's movie? That he is the one with the character arc?
You know, I couldn't say that either, because no. It's not like...
Nobody has a character arc in this.
I think the kid does, I guess.
Kinda?
The kid is close to the kid.
I feel like the kid, no matter what he does, he always gets rewarded for it.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a moment where it's like, for heroism in the face of danger, we're making you an honorary detective. And it's like, you know that little shit stole from you 5 minutes ago when you didn't have to, right?
Yeah, this
like,
movie...
There's actually a dilemma in the early years of this strip where it's like, the kid contemplates stealing from Dick Tracy and is of strong moral fiber that he ultimately decides not to. But this kid is just like, ah, fuck that, I'm buying sodas with this.
There's not, like you said, there are no character arcs in this movie, really. You know, like, we watch to compare it to Batman, generally you watch it like, oh, what's Batman's motivation? Oh, his parents were killed, he's decided to become a vigilante and avenge their memories or something. And what are the villain's motivations? Oh, the Joker is like an agent of chaos, and he loves just sowing discord wherever he goes. And in this movie, it's basically, what are the motivations? Big Boy Caprice wants to do a crime, and Dick Tracy wants to stop him from doing a crime. And that's literally it. There's nothing
deep. It's good enough for Dino Saucers, it's good enough for Dick Tracy, right?
yeah, seriously.
Dick Tracy's motivation is to be a deputized agent and extension of the state. Like, he is very much the long arm of the law made flesh. That was the way Chester Gould, who was, as you might imagine, quite a bit of a law and order nut, mm-hmm. went about him, was... Mike, are you familiar with the anecdote that Jay Gould and I think it's Jay Gould and Robert Crumb tell?
I am not.
Basically, it's like they visited Chester Gould in 1968, and they got on pretty well, honestly. Except he saw like a black teenager outside the window of their building, and he pointed to him and he said, "If any punk tried any funny stuff with me, I'd break both his arms and set him on fire."
That seems extremely Chester Gould.
Law and order.
Wow. It's interesting that he would get along well with Robert Crumb, but, you know, Mr. Underground alt comics guy. He's like, who loves doing drugs and getting sat on by giant asses. But
it turns out they had that in common.
I mean, I wouldn't put it past Chester Gold. He's like, I'm going to create a villain with a giant ass that can sit on me. That's how he does crimes.
I'm going to call her Big Ass Baby.
Okay. I'm going to call him Rolls Royce like... Rump.
So, I have a question. This movie, it feels like it's an incredibly simple, slight storyline, and yet so much happens that it's so confusing. Because
I don't really have a problem with it, because all of the exposition is told in very much... scenes unfold within the nature of, a serialized, dramatic comic strip would.
I will say one thing. This movie sure loves its montages. We get at least three.
Yeah.
We maybe get four. I'm struggling to think. And all of them are completely soundless except for the Stephen Sondheim songs we paid a lot of money for.
Yep.
I mean, that was apparently a huge coup to get Stephen Sondheim songs in this thing. And
Sondheim and Madonna, of course.
Yeah. They really love these Stephen Sondheim. I mean, they paid a lot of money, so they're like, we're going to use it, because instead of fitting the song to the montage, they fit the montage to the song. So after about 10 minutes, you're like, is this going to end? I'm not a big fan. I don't know much about the Stephen Sondheim character, but I know what I like, and I don't like him. It's like I like when Danny Elfman is doing stuff on the soundtrack, but then when they get into that, we're going to do big band 1920s music, it's like, yeah, I know you can do good 1920s music that's kind of got a fat beat you can bug out to, but I was just like, oh my God, I am not feeling it.
I was kind of feeling the other way. I was I was enjoying the 1920s stuff, but when we got into Danny Elfman, I mean, Danny basically has two different Proteus modules. One that has a children's choir that goes la 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 la. And for this one, he used the other one that has the trumpets going da 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 da.
I mean, I won't deny there, the Batman theme and the Batman score in general, its subtleties, its weird subtleties are a thing of beauty. Danny Elfman had to, he was whispering all of the parts of the Batman score into a tape recorder while he was on a commercial flight, because it popped into his head and he didn't want to lose it when he got on the tarmac. So eventually, the flight attendants had to, say, sir, why are you going to the bathroom every 10 minutes if you don't feel ill? And the unspoken truth was, are you doing cocaine, Danny Elfman? But no, it was this. It led to a truly classic, emblematic theme. And...
The story behind the theme
by comparison is just dun 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 dun. Not terribly interesting.
No.
They said Danny Elfman himself says that when they played the Batman score, the theme from Batman, for the first time for the producer listened for about 30 seconds and then he got up and started, pretending to conduct. And they're like, yeah, we got a hit here.
Wow. I don't think you'd have that with the Dick Tracy theme. I don't think anyone would have that reaction. It doesn't get you pumping some others. But I feel maybe slagging on the music is being a little churlish considering so much other stuff to slag on in this film.
Yeah.
So like we said, I think the main plot is Big Boy Caprice wants to unite all the crime lords in the city that Dick Tracy lives in.
What's it called?
Is it Gotham?
Apparently there's a freeze frame or whatever to look at the city and it says Homeville, which seems like something a prop master came up with on the fly. Traditionally, Dick Tracy has always been based in Chicago.
Oh, that makes sense, because that's where gangsters live.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so Dick Tracy, so Big Boy Caprice wants to unite all the crime lords of Chicago or Boonville, and the Dick Tracy has to stop that from happening. Mm-hmm. And there's also a love triangle happening because Dick Tracy has a girlfriend, Tess Trueheart, but also Big Boy's main singer, Breathless Mahoney, is around. And there's also a small...
Around is a good way to describe her.
Yeah. And there's also a small child.
She's always around.
There. Yeah.
And there's this child that Dick Tracy gets a hold of and may or may not adopt. And I think that's the main things that are going on in this movie.
I guess the real character arc, if there is one for Tracy, is that he doesn't want to be put behind a desk. You know, he doesn't feel alive unless he's going out and getting shot at, and he's afraid that if he gets made the district attorney or whatever, then he's not going to be able to do that anymore. And so I guess it's more of a struggle to not change.
It is funny because it's basically like Tess Trueheart is all like, Dick Tracy, you need to get behind a desk because I don't want no man of mine getting shot in the ass in the line of duty or something. Where's that effect? She doesn't say that, of course. And then she goes and stays with her mother, and her mother's like, man like Dick Tracy is a man of action. He's not going to change. You need to change and accept that. And then she comes back to Dick Tracy. He's like, Dick Tracy, I accept that you will always be a cop. And that's kind of the way – I was kind of surprised when I watched that because I was expecting, you know, usually the main character is the one who undergoes a change. But in this one, it was Tess being like, you know, you're right. I was being a dumb dame. Now –
the change that Dick Tracy goes through is being more irritable and shitty after Tess, like, leaves him.
Yeah.
Basically, the only thing you see is, like, he yells at people in the office and eventually says, the kid, like, fuck you. I'm tired of this shit. I am being hounded by Mary Warnov. Rock and Roll High School's Mary Warnov in a pointless cameo as a social worker. And we're taking you away to the orphanage.
Man, speaking of Mary Warnov, you know, the classic actress we know from such movies as Warlock and Terror Vision and Hellhole. Mm-hmm. This movie has just an endless parade of incredibly talented and famous actors in it, none of whom have anything to do.
No.
Kathy Bates is just sitting there.
Yeah, Kathy Bates is in this? I didn't even notice her.
Bates was the stenographer during the Mumbles interrogation.
Oh my god, that is... what a waste. You've got, like... Dustin Hoffman.
And this was the same year as Misery. Shit.
Wow. Wow. Yeah, there's just like, it's incredible. There's also like, yeah, Dustin Hoffman is Mumbles. And it's like, he mumbles. He doesn't like do anything. Mandy Patinkin, Paul Sorvino, just like.
Well, at least Mandy Patinkin gets to sing. But...
yes.
Mandy Patinkin I was amazed by it because I know he's like a talented guy, but it's like, does Mandy Patinkin have more vocal range than Madonna? Because that falsetto is beautiful.
Yeah, Madonna has... you know what? Madonna is, like, just so flat throughout this whole movie.
It is technically her best... it is her best dramatic role, I would say. But that's only because, like, she... by playing the vamp... she gets to, like, let a look, like a smoky look and, like, sort of a hard-boiled line do the emoting for her. Like, she's very bottled up.
Yeah. Like, I mean, Madonna is
this
not
is basically Madonna playing herself.
Oh yeah, Madonna's not like a great actor at all, or even a good actor. But I mean, I think it's a little unfair to judge her because she's, you know, she's not an actor, she's a singer. But even her singing just feels like so lackluster in this.
She smoked specifically for it to get the feel of these 30s crooners.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe it's just me, but I was like, yeah, like Mandy Patinkin just blows her out of the water. it's just so weird seeing Madonna sing and being like, oh yeah, I guess she's singing. All right.
It is. It's funny because I was never a big Madonna fan, but I think I'm a bigger Breathless Mahoney fan than Madonna.
God, I guess like she is playing Madonna. She's like you said, she's the vamp. She's just there to kind of be sexy, and she's as sexy as you can be in a Dick Tracy movie because you know, Dick Tracy is such a sexless character, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
I mean, did you notice that the Dick Tracy cartoon, the one that they re-aired because of this movie and then got taken off the air in certain markets because they'd forgotten how racist it was?
Oh, right. Joe.
Yes. That show had no female characters whatsoever.
Yeah. This is, that's the thing. It's like in this one, like, a friend of mine described the Dick Tracy movie as like, this is a movie if you think the coolest thing in the world is having a watch that you can talk to people through. And it really is, because, you know, this is not a movie for people who like being horny, you know. It feels like they were like, okay, Madonna, be sexy, and they were, and no one really knew what that meant. Like the scene where there's a love triangle between Dick Tracy, Breathless Mahoney, and Tess Trueheart, which I don't get why. Because
it never feels like it makes sense.
I don't think there really is a love triangle, or does she just make a couple of passes at him? Well, it feels like more the scene where Eddie Valiant has his pants down when Jessica Rabbit is talking to him.
It's ironic because I accept Bob Hoskins as a sexual being in Who Framed Roger Rabbit to an extent, but Warren Beatty, famous handsome man of stage and screen, is by comparison quite sexless.
Yes.
And when you see him, like, oh, this is a purely carnal relationship he has with Breathless, like, he's motivated by sexual feelings. It's like, does that have any room in Dick Tracy's body?
No, that's exactly it, because I agree with you. Bob Hoskins, I can see him and be like, that is an earthly man with earthly urges. You know, even if we don't necessarily see them play it on screen, I believe it. And Dick Tracy, like, when there's that scene where Breathless Mahoney shows up with ice cream and delivers this incredibly filthy line that I was like, what, is that from a different movie?
That's the classic we hate movies, I've got kids here line, where it's like, I brought you some peach ice cream. Better hurry, it's starting to run.
Yeah, it's just...
Something like that.
It's it's like, better eat it up before it starts to drip. Yeah, it's just like, whoa. And Warren Beatty as Dick Tracy just reacts with an emotion that I think, Ethan, you will be familiar with, dull surprise. That is his reaction
to... Oh, good, I like peach.
Yeah, just everything that happens in this movie, Warren Beatty is just... always has this expression of just kind of bafflement. So...
Nothing goes over my head. My reflexes are too quick.
I feel like Warren Beatty, he's not really a strong actor. He's just, you know, he's a guy who kind of gets by because he's good looking and he's kind of charming.
Which makes it funny that he wanted to have the facial prosthetics too in this movie. He wanted them to give him the actual Dick Tracy nose and chin.
Like a super sharp profile.
Yeah, but
I think that could work.
I don't know if they decided against it for aesthetic reasons or if it was just like, no, we can't cover up the star.
Now, I understand this was actually kind of a passion project for Warren Beatty. I think he actually owned the rights to Dick Tracy.
Still does.
Yeah, he's still holding on to it. This was also his first movie
those
after
Ishtar.
Those
specials are so fucking weird. Really?
Yeah, so this was his big return after Ishtar. In fact, he even got Dustin Hoffman to come back. So, you know, I guess this is a spiritual sequel in a way.
Yeah. Now, earlier I mentioned Roger Rabbit as the idea of it being a spiritual sequel. And what brings me to that is a scene in the book Who Censored Roger Rabbit. This is something that didn't make it into the actual movie, but there's a scene in the book where Eddie Valiant goes to the police and Dick Tracy is there. And Dick Tracy is signing autographs, of course, because he's a celebrity, but he's also being consulted on cases like he was a real cop. Huh. And that's the actual phrase they use, like a real cop, suggesting that he's not one. And Eddie is, you know, he kind of resents that this cartoon character is getting the kind of treatment that from actual cops. But at the same time, he is like, well, I kind of want his autograph, too. He's kind of what we all want to be. So
maybe it is when you say like a real cop, does it specify that he has only cartoon jurisdiction?
I think it's just that he's, you know, like all toons are actors. All toons perform in comic strips in this movie, or this book.
So it's the equivalent of Tom Clancy, like, wearing a Navy hat everywhere.
Does he? I didn't know that.
Well, he did.
Yeah. But, speaking of carrying a badge of office everywhere, I can't believe that that Dan Aykroyd wasn't involved with this. Cop lover himself.
I mean, given the, I think Warren Beatty is trying to shoot for something like very, very straight-laced, not unlike Aykroyd's Joe Friday in the movie Dragnet. Like that super stiff ness that ironically makes him kind of uncompelling as a heroic figure. He's really more, Dick Tracy is really more of an instrument of retribution.
Yeah.
Like, the strip will follow the criminal along their path, and then at the very end, like, in the Gould years, it was usually, like, he came across the villain frozen to death, or got trapped in, like, a car compactor or something, and just said, like, well, such as the weed of crime bears bitter fruit, or whatever, and then it just kind of disappeared. and they lay a sheet over them.
Speaking of,
I appreciate that this movie does continue the strip's violence. Like,
oh yes,
yeah.
Bath.
It does in a very odd way, because I feel like it kind of just strings you along for about, like, you know, an hour a half or however long it runs, and then every single criminal runs out of the club, gets in a car, drives 5 feet, and then gets mowed down by Dick Tracy with a Tommy gun, just like dozens of these guys, and that's the end of the movie.
It's sort
they
of
all
yeah,
run
it's...
into a Bonnie and Clyde roadblock.
Yeah, they really do. It's like, oh, these criminal masterminds, all you need to do the whole time is, well, also, let's talk about Dick Tracy. He is not a
good
cop.
No.
That's an interesting point. Do you think that Warren Beatty was thinking of his time filming Bonnie and Clyde and called Michael J. Pollard to be a weird guy?
Oh, that's right, because Michael J. Pollard is, he's the guy with the big ears, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a bugging expert. It's like, Hey, Warren, why'd you call me? Well, I'm doing this great big movie. Like, all of my friends are in it, Michael, and I thought maybe you could join me. It's Dick Tracy. Oh, wow, like the comic strip. What do you need me for? Well, you look like a troll doll.
Oh, Oh, I didn't know the guy's name was Bug Bailey. That makes it all the funnier that he's undone by a roach.
Is he named
Bug Bailey? It's disgusting.
So is Bug Bailey named Bug because he works with, like, bugging stuff?
Don't overthink the name.
Is the name a pun on Beetle Bailey?
Oh.
No.
Well, here's the thing. That is another weird, like, thing. This movie has so many odd twists because, but, like, Dick Tracy, he goes to, like, you know, he goes to, like, Big Boy's club and he roughs him up, but, like, then they install a bug while he's distracted. And then Bug Bailey is, like, living in the ceiling. Like, it's not like it's a radio that transmits to somewhere where they're bugged. There's, like, a literal guy just in the crawl space above the ceiling. And then he gets caught, and they try and encase him in cement, which is, like, really gruesome if you think about it. Like,
yeah.
He's being encased alive in cement. But I assume Dick Tracy saves him, because Dick Tracy shows up and shoots
one
of these people.
This is such a fucking stupid switch, because it's, like, Bug about to get the bath, and then they turn around, and there's Dick Tracy standing there willingly getting concrete poured all over him.
Yeah, I was wondering about
that. It is so much that it jams his gun.
I was wondering about that. I was like, isn't that bad? Shouldn't he get that off real fast, I feel like? But I don't know.
In addition, what was the need to have a guy living upstairs when Dick has a radio on his watch at all times? He could have attached that to the ceiling fan and just been listening 24/7.
Yeah, that whole thing seemed... Well, then, like, because it's this whole sequence where, like Big Boy is mad because Dick Tracy's always ahead of me every step. And then they find the bug guy, and then it's like, now I'm ahead of Dick Tracy every step. And it's like, okay. This whole thing seems like it didn't really lead anywhere. We're just wasting time. But I don't know.
Let me talk to you. Where are all these coffee cans of piss coming around? All around the club.
Oh my god.
Pissing in coffee cans.
Morb, that is actually the best Al Capone. That's better than Al Capone does. Fuck Al Capone, that fucking Al Pacino. Oh my god, I'm stupid.
I think my favorite Big Boy being hammy scene is, like, for sheer pointlessness, is a bit where he's just, like, doing the routine with the dancers.
Oh,
it's kind of like... It's kind of like that one Kids in the Hall sketch where Bruce McCullough loses all of his money just paying women in their underwear to dance.
Again. Again. Boy. Doka. Again.
Apparently Madonna was not happy with that scene because Al Pacino was, like, actually slapping her ass throughout it.
He slaps her face at the end. That's he gets a little rough a couple of times, and I don't know if he's a method student or whatever, but I get the feeling like he would hit you probably a little harder than he had to.
I would not put it past him. but I guess at least he's doing something in this movie because nobody else is.
Yeah.
Everyone else, like I said, is like you got like a lots of. Of well-known actors who are under like 20 pounds of foam rubber and not really doing much.
The craziest is Henry Silva as influence because he already has like those cheekbones. So like, what are you adding?
Yeah.
It's like,
okay. Let's talk
like
about
Ron Perlman as Hellboy. Like the makeup is only adding to what's there.
Yeah.
And also why is influence here at all in the form of, yeah, Wikipedia says he's Pruneface's sinister top gunman when influence is a hypnotist. Why is he a gunman in this? And
why did we waste the character of the Brow in, like, why did they waste the character of the Brow, who is, like, normally a Nazi saboteur, to be just, like, another weird guy that gets gunned down?
But biggest disappointment for me was Mumbles. Now, everyone knows, you know, if you ask someone to name Dick Tracy characters, they'll probably come out with, like, Flat Top, Prune Face, Mumbles, and, you know, Mumble, but the thing about Mumbles is that he doesn't just talk funny, he's a freaking crooner! He's a singer! He should have had a song during the you know, when Madonna took her break. But no, they just have him as kind of a stooge that just sort of talks funny.
Yeah. You know.
Well,
and he talks funny on purpose. That's what makes me so mad.
Well, Dustin Hoffman sang in Warren Beatty's last film, like, why risk it?
Yeah. I think probably the actor that I feel was the most wasted among all these wasted actors, though, Charles Durning appears as the chief of police. And you all know Charles Durning, great character actor, of course, plays big, fat, sweaty Southern dudes.
Yeah.
He's in every Coen Brothers movie. You know, he was the Big Lebowski. He's Doc Hopper and, you know, the Muppets.
Yeah.
And he has nothing to do. It's so weird. The first scene, he and Dick Tracy are getting chewed out by, like, the DA. And he's just sitting there. And I was like, is that Charles Durning? No, it couldn't be. They wouldn't put him in here if he didn't have anything to say. But later on, he's got, like, two lines or something. And it's just like, seriously, you're going to put Charles Durning in your movie and just have him do nothing? What's up with that?
I fear that, Mike, you, as well as I have when remembering this movie, I was like, oh, he looks different than I remember. And I remembered, oh, shit, no, wait, that's David Huddleston I'm thinking of. Charles Durning, totally separate guy.
Oh, wait, is he not in this?
Charles Durning is in Dick Tracy, but he is not the Big Lebowski.
Oh, shit, wait, who is, So, is Charles Durning, but is he Doc Hopper?
Yes, he is. That's correct.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, my God.
You're thinking of his role as the devil in Oh, Brother, Where Art Thou?
Oh, shit, I didn't realize.
No, wait. He wasn't the devil. He was Pappy O'Daniel. That's right.
That's it, yes.
David Huddleston was Pappy O'Daniel. I think Charles Durning might have been in that.
No, Charles Durning's Pappy O'Daniel.
Wait, I'm going to look it up. Let's see. What has he actually been in? Okay. Gotta scroll down. He is in why, let's see, what the hell, why can't I find him? Okay. Old Brother.
I think I'll go for my most wasted actor was Catherine O'Hara as Taxi Garcia.
Did she have a line?
I do not think she has a line. I think she just stands there and looks plaintive and then operates the whorehouse off screen and then gets busted. It's a shame because, again, from the first few years of Dick Tracy, I really loved Taxi Garcia as like a villainess, and that could have been a thing to do more with. And she was originally like romantically linked to Big Boy, so
I guess they would decided Breathless Mahoney is going to play that role.
Yeah,
I guess.
Yeah, again, pretty sexless world. We don't even get to see Mrs. Pruneface.
No. Speaking of the sexless world, and this is very weird, I feel, because during the time this movie was made, Warren Beatty and Madonna were dating, you know? So it is very weird that they have absolutely no on-screen chemistry. They are just like, I just was like, why are these two people hanging out?
It's always the way, isn't it? It's like, We're not like really reviewing the movie. We're reviewing their relationship through the movie. But either way, like they did break up. I believe they may have been married, or at least very heavily romantically linked. And you can see a lot of Warren Beatty just sort of like hanging around on the sidelines in Madonna's Truth or Dare concert video.
Mm. Yeah,
just like making fun of her and shit.
Well, what an ass.
Warren Beatty is, like, I will go on record as saying, like, a real piece of shit in general, but it is kind of funny how much he doesn't care.
I mean, he doesn't have to.
As big a piece of shit as Sean Penn.
There is no ceiling. Like, you can't go higher than Sean Penn, especially Sean Penn in the 80s.
Yeah. the love triangle in this movie, like I said, I don't feel like there's any chemistry between any of these three people, and it ends in the weirdest way, because there's this subplot. The Blank is also in this movie, who, spoilers, it turns out it's Breathless Mahoney.
To imagine that Madonna did the voice.
She did. Oh, we hear her kind of fade out of it as she's, you know, dying throes.
No, that was dubbed. I'm just...
It was dubbed?
That was dubbed over her. Yeah. I would have liked that to be the case, though. Just like...
Yeah.
Is anyone credited as the voice of the Blank?
Do you have any other talents? Oh, well, I can do this.
And Denny isn't here, Mrs. Torrance.
Yeah, she's doing the thing where she speaks in glottal fry inhaled.
Well, so Madonna, a.k.a. Breathless Mahoney, has this plan to basically take over, I think. She's like, she wants to, you know, she's going to double-cross Big Boy. And first she's going to get rid of Tracy. Then she's going to double-cross Big Boy. But then she wants to get with Tracy at the end, because she's all like, because at the end, when they're in a big clock or something, you know, there's like
a little bit of Castle of Cagliostro's action there.
Yeah, yeah. I was going to say, you need a big clock so people can, like, fall into gears and stuff, you know? Mm-hmm. Have a good classic Dick Tracy villain death, you know, being crushed death between giant gears. They really kind of wuss out, though, because Big Boy does not get, like, gruesomely killed. He just falls.
He just fell down a hole and you don't see what happens because, you know, maybe we won't want him back.
I have to imagine, like, with all that padding, he just passed through them like Charlie Chaplin.
But this scene...
The join me and rule by my side thing is especially ridiculous. Is, like, Dick Tracy previously refused to accept a significant bribe from Big Boy. So it's like, hey, maybe he'll join me after he beats this man to death with his bare hands.
Yeah, that was exactly
what
it.
What kind of ultimatum is that?
It is a very... It's very weird that, like, look, we've established that Dick Tracy is incorruptible, so this scene really has no weight, especially because it's like the Blank is just randomly saying, hey, you should join me. Okay. Why? He's like, we'll rule this city together. Will we? What does Dick Tracy bring to this?
I guess the Blank wasn't there to see the bribe happen, though.
Well, that's true, but here's the other thing. I also thought it was funny because... Dick Tracy, terrible cop. Like, he spends his entire movie literally just, like, harassing any freak that he meets, you know? And everyone in the police department is, Dick Tracy, you can't just bring, you know, freaks in here and beat them up. They've got rights, you know? And he's like, here's what I think of your rights. Bam, bam.
Some call police brutality. He calls it justice.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's par for the course to Tracy. But the part of the issue is that the DA keeps saying, like, we can't prosecute. We can't got no evidence. Which, you know, is like, that's pretty typical, like, police procedural thing to happen. The DA is always, you know, saying shit like that to give the cops something to fight against. But in this movie, it turns out the DA is on the take from Big Boy. Right. So, which is actually kind of a neat twist, I thought, because, it explained, like, as opposed to just being, like, a weird bleeding heart that, like, loves criminals having rights, which usually is what they do with DAs in movies. So at least it's explained why he's so reluctant to actually, you know, stop crime. So technically, it's like, why are you, you know, but then Blank kills the DA and tries to frame Tracy. Right? And so at the end, it's like, Blank, why do you want to work with Tracy? You had everything that you would have working with Tracy previously with working with the DA, because the DA was keeping Tracy on a leash. But you killed the DA. Now what? That was not a good plan. That didn't work at all.
Just think, you can rule by my side. You, with all the powers and abilities of a disgraced police detective on the run for murder.
Yeah, it was not a well thought out plan. And
By the way, an excellent example of that, like, very punchy, very on-the-nose comic strip exposition is, like, Dick Van Dyke exposits that he is the DA and that he's going to be running for mayor by saying, I'm the DA! I'm going to be running for mayor soon!
Oh, that's right. Dick Van Dyke is in this as well. So
yeah.
Like, there's a lot of weird comic strip touches, like Spaldoni. And by the way, imagine being James Caan and, like, working with Al Pacino in The Godfather, and then it's, like, almost 20 years later, and he's, like, vamping across the table from you in, like, this horrendous fat suit. Must be a weird feeling. But anyway, when Spaldoni goes up in a car bomb, both Pat and Sam Ketchum both yell "Great Scott" in unison, which is very much like a comic strip thing. Like, they just do it independently and of their own volition.
You can see the two tails coming from the same word balloon.
Lindsay, so much about Dick Tracy that we're splitting this into two episodes. So join us next week for our conclusion to our discussion of Dick Tracy the movie, plus just a completely unrelated digression about We're Back, a Dinosaur's Story, and other stuff.